And I think that we all, you know, deserve a lot of credit and a communal pat on the back, because we have been working hard. And that struggle is not going to get any easier. And that's why we're here, because we need to keep fighting together. It's in the spirit that, you know, we are so fortunate to have great speakers with us this afternoon. Another great benefit of getting together is we don't only get to learn from each other, but there are people here, Susanna Daly, Juan Torres, and Anthony Arnov are all here to share their experiences with us so that we can learn from them. The first speaker this evening will be Susanna Daly. She's worked on issues ranging from Palestine to local concerns for the Arab and Muslim communities. She's currently devoting her energy to the Mohamed Salah case. He's an American citizen of Palestinian descent who in 2004 was charged by the federal government with aiding terrorist organizations. The only evidence that they had was a 1993 forced confession, however. He spent 80 days being interrogated and tortured in an Israeli jail to get that. And I think it's just another example of the racism, you know, inherent in this war, in one of the basic human rights issues that we are facing in the struggle. So, Susanna Daly.
Hi, everybody. Just wanted to say thank you to the organizers. It's really great to know that this is going on. I thought that I would just sort of spend most of the time that I have to speak to you trying to give you a bit of the narrative of this particular case, because, you know, it's one case among many. And it's in a lot of aspects a repeat of history in the way that, you know, the police state that exists, and now this global police state is really, you know, trying to, you know, break the spirit and the will of political movements and those of us who have the potential to build stronger political movements. And so, and then maybe perhaps leave just a little bit of a time to start talking about really the significance of this particular case and what exactly it means for our political age and, you know, the struggle that we sort of have ahead of us. And hopefully that will come up in discussion as well. Mohamed Salah is a Palestinian and U.S. citizen. He's been a U.S. citizen for over 20 years, and he's lived in Bridgeview, Illinois, which is the southwest suburb of Chicago, which is one of the communities that I've worked in as a Arab American community organizer. There's a large Arab population there. There's a local mosque, two Arab churches. And I knew about the case fleetingly and had about a year ago the fortune to sit down and talk to Mr. Salah's wife and some of the lawyers who had been representing him. And we learned of the case and exactly what it was entailing. And since that time, we've been able to build a pretty strong and growing citywide coalition to really look at the effects of the war on terrorism in the Arab community and look at the issue of torture, both in the United States as it manifests in cases such as the John Birch case, and look at torture in the context of issues like Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, and to talk about torture in the context of this specific individual in this specific case. Are you okay? Yeah. Okay. Mr. Salah, in 1993, traveled to the occupied territories, and he was sent to deliver some money that was raised in the local Arab community for about 400 families whose sons and fathers and uncles were deported by the Israeli government to Lebanon. That occurred in 1992. It was an act that was condemned by the international community, including the United States. The majority of those families being in Gaza, those men who were deported were accused of being members of Hamas. They were accused by the Israeli government. At the time, Hamas was not on the State Department, U.S. State Department list of terrorist organizations. Mr. Salah declared the money as he left Chicago. He declared the money as he entered Israel. He made sure that the money went to the families. And upon approaching a checkpoint in Gaza near a hospital that he was visiting, he was arrested by 20 Israeli Defense Forces. Well, we try to refer to them as Israeli occupying forces. He was brutalized, not knowing at the time that simultaneously, two other Palestinians with U.S. citizenship who were visiting in the occupied territories were being arrested at the same time. Mr. Salah was taken to an interrogation facility in Ramallah, and the case has a lot of details and a lot of complications, and I'm not going to attempt to really sort of talk to you about every single one. But what ended up happening in brief is that he arrived at the interrogation facility in late January, and he left the interrogation facility in May. And throughout that time, he was being tortured by Israeli interrogators and by other Palestinians who were working as collaborators for the Israeli interrogators. And as a result of that experience, he ended up signing some papers that the Israeli government says are allegedly his confessions, and confessions that say that he's allegedly a member of Hamas, and that he was a senior member of Hamas, actually, and that he was in the territories to deliver funds for terrorist activity. And the confessions that he was forced to sign under the coercion, under the torture, most of them happened in the first 36 hours, and most of them were actually in Hebrew, a language that he both did not read or could not understand in any capacity. So after being released from the interrogation facility, and throughout the time being in the interrogation facility, he did appear a few times in an Israeli military court. And an Israeli military court is basically a group of judges, only one who actually has any legal expertise, and everybody in the room is an actual Israeli soldier or officer. And each time that he entered, he was sent back to the interrogation facility. And after he finally left the interrogation facility and went to a military court, and he was able to consult with a lawyer for the first time, and he was sentenced to 5 years in an Israeli prison. He served those 5 years and returned back to Bridgeview, Illinois, where his wife and his children were living. And when he got back to Illinois, he discovered that the Clinton administration had placed him on a list called the Specially Designated Terrorist List. And Mr. Salah was the first U.S. citizen to ever be put on that list. Actually, I'm not sure if there's another citizen who's on that list right now, but who knows. He basically had no opportunity whatsoever to argue never given a reason why he was on that list, was never given an opportunity to argue the reasons why he was on that list. And as a result, all of his financial assets were frozen, and he had to receive special permission from the government to receive any type of goods and services, including going to a doctor, going to a store to purchase anything which will be documented, going to school. And so during the Clinton administration, there was a pursuit to try to indict Mr. Salah here for the same charges. And using the effective Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, they attempted to do that. But the Department of Justice at the time basically said, you have no evidence against him, and so we're throwing the case out. However, after 9/11 and the political climate changed, not so significantly, because it was very much the same way before, but it changed in a particular way that sort of gave these sorts of institutions opportunities to go forth with things that they wanted to go to actually implement before, like the Patriot Act. And so in 2004 he was indicted, and he is being charged right now with the RICO law, which is a racketeering law, one that they often use against, I think, organized crime. And he's being charged with material support to a terrorist organization. And so a lot of things throughout the years, because, you know, it's 12 years later, actually, that he was arrested for crimes that he allegedly committed 12 years ago. And, you know, throughout the, you know, the story, you know, up until this particular time, you know, there are a lot of information that has come forward in terms of exactly what was happening behind the scenes. And one thing that I guess people sort of had strong hunch about and are getting a lot of information confirming is that there was correspondence between Israel and the U.S. government about Mr. Salah and his detention. The U.S. consulate in Israel was doing their job in inquiring into the safety of the U.S. citizens who were currently in Israeli custody. But there was other correspondence that was going on between the FBI and the Israeli Secret Service. FBI trying to use the Secret Service to get information out of Mr. Salah, the Secret Service trying to get information about Mr. Salah from the FBI. And, you know, it is the belief of some people that the interest that really, you know, both the Israelis and the U.S. government really had in pursuing this one particular case, because they wanted to try to create a link between what they call Palestinian terrorism in the occupied territories to the Palestinian Arab American community in the United States. And I think, just like in the LA 8 case, if any of you are familiar with that, these students who were accused of giving out material that belonged to a Marxist-Leninist Palestinian faction that is now on the State Department terrorist list. They were students, they were on student visas. And really the case against them was kind of like a prototype to see how far the government can really go in prosecuting these men and that one woman. And I feel like that Mr. Salah is really the prototype to see how far a government can go in prosecuting a U.S. citizen, putting somebody in jail for life for material support. 10 minutes, is it? Yeah? Okay. Well, I'm just going to end by saying that what is occurring right now in the court of law is a suppression hearing, whereas the defense had filed a motion saying that the U.S. cannot use confessions obtained under torture anywhere, and even so much a foreign country, as evidence to prosecute a U.S. citizen is a violation of due process, it's a violation of human rights. And so that is the hearing that's taking place right now. And part of that hearing, actually, 8 days of that hearing was done in secret. It was closed to the public and it was closed to the media. We expected for one day of that hearing to be in secret. That was the day when they were allowing for the Israeli interrogators who came to the United States to testify. And We found out that after all of those 8 days had passed, we found out that there were hours and hours of those 8 days that actually took place in the judges' chambers, where not one person from the defense team was allowed to be in the room. And this is all under the guise of classified information. The hearing is still taking place, and the next hearing date is actually going to be this Thursday, beginning at 8 a.m. If anybody is sort of interested in coming out to support, please let me know. And when this is done, please ask me some questions.
Thank you, Suzanne. The next person that we'll have speaking is Juan Torres. He is he's a friend of Campus Anti-War at UIC, you know, frequently pitching in to help us out. He actually spoke, he did a Iraq Vets and Parents Speak Out for us on campus last semester, where Eric Alberg also, you know, made his UIC debut. Mr. Torres lost his son in Afghanistan. He was only 25 years old, and his death has been enshrouded in a pretty thick web of lies and just military misdeeds. And he's dedicated his life now to speaking out on behalf of other military families as a member of Gold Star Families for Peace. We're very honored to have Juan with us once again.
Good afternoon. So, how is it working? So, I'm a little bit tired. You know, I just came for 3 hours. I actually speak when I'm group like 20, 21 kids. It's maybe 45 miles, 50 miles from Milwaukee. But anyway, I stay here. So, you know, I have one of my best friends now, Cindy Sheehan. We've been around the country before. She was famous, you know, in Texas, Crawford, Texas. I remember, you know, we'd be in different city, 25 people, maybe 7, sometimes 10 people. One day we see in Missouri, we count 45 people. Wow, beautiful. Look at how many people. And now, after Crawford, Texas, something has changed, you know. But finally, every day, I speak to a different group of kids, and every day I have a new experience. I want something, the experience, you know, they keep, you know, when I stay in my house, and they say, Juan, you need relax, you need sleeping, something, you know, but I stay a couple of days in my house, and I keep crying. Because I know my family, and we talk the same way about Cindy. Our family is destroyed forever. What kind of solution we have? We don't have a solution. Just keep it on and fight for the other kids. So, and I'm so happy when I receive something letter for the kid, and I start receiving a lot of time, chocolate. I don't like the chocolate, but I give up a lot of chocolate in my house now. Flowers, I don't have a time for put the water because I be outside all the time. But I very sad I remember. And 10 months ago, I've been in Tampa, Florida, and I speak with one kid, Willie. I remember he's from Colombia. He's a very skinny guy and short guy. And he has a short hair, so I heard mother coming to me. I speak in one church. You know, he's my son, Willie. He's, I know I take attention when you speak, Mr. Torres. It's in Spanish, you know, it's better for me in Spanish. So, but my son is in the same circumstance. The military lie in the school. And the recruiting men, they say, so, Willie, you know it's Willie, right? Yes, Willie, you can go enjoy to the boot camp. If you like it, you can go out, no problem. Find this boy, he don't have any information like I got before, and my son is died too. His boy is go to a boot camp, I said, yes, Mr. Torre, I was now in the army like 6-7 months, around close to 7 months. I'll be in South Carolina now, training. But I don't think so. I'll be in the reserve. I don't think so they send me to Iraq or anywhere because I'll be in the reserve. And I told this boy, you know, my son was in the reserve too. And my son is dying. He's a little bit scary. But don't think it's not scary, you know. But when I see the body, he's like maybe 100 pounds. Very short guy, skinny, and he talk that very friendly. He looked like my son when I see a nice boy. And I don't see this guy for anymore. But her mother called me after 3 months, 3 and 4 months. Mr. Torres, somebody called me on my phone. You don't remember the Willie mother? Yes, I remember. You're from Colombia? Yes, yes. Because she's every day different people, you know, around. And sometimes say, you don't remember me? Yes, no, I don't know. Because you see every day. But I remember her, you know, because I remember this nice boys coming on me. So my son is going to Iraq the next week. They want to send my son to Iraq, so, and I told, you know, you want to be a, can help your son. No, but my son, he want to go try, maybe nothing happen. And this boy, go to Iraq. And a month ago, maybe 35 to 40 day close, somebody called me like close to 11:30, 12 o'clock night. I'm very scared because they called to my house late. And somebody crying the phone, so I don't know, maybe somebody, when I say maybe my daughter from Texas or something problem. And finally say, who's calling? She's crying. Who's calling? Sorry. When I went, I don't put the phone down. I keep stay with my phone in my hand. So you remember Mr. Torres? I am the Willie mother. You don't remember me? Yes. Yes, what's happened? My son is dying. And I 3 and 4 days, I don't sleeping. Because I remember this boy. I don't remember me and my son. And I suffer every day when kids go to the army, go to the somewhere, you know, Iraq, Afghanistan. And I'm now, I'm very sad because I got this boy. He sent me email, this called me this morning, Damian Campos from Mexico City. He's illegal, he don't have a paper. He's mentioned right here in the email. He's called from Fallujah, send the email. He's called me this morning again, he cried. Mr. Torre, I want to go back, please, do something. So, and I call everywhere, I call to a couple of congressmen, but nobody pay attention, nobody don't care. But this guy is 19 years old. He's refusing about the paper, about everything, but he wanted coming back. How we do it, you know? And before last night, I told, you know, I don't know how much information about the soldier when he refused to go to. I call, you know, Camilo Mejia. I call a couple more guys. He refused to go back to the military. So by saying, I'm sorry, Juan, but we have information, but it's in America. In Iraq, we never have any problem. Like, oh, something, people, they refuse to go to. And I told the guy, when they, you have something close to you, yeah, I got a captain close to me. So go say the captain, you don't want to go, because last night I had one mission in the night. And she say, okay, you say you refuse, you don't feel better, you are mentally, you are, I'm sorry, you depressed. Say something, please. You say you don't feel better. And he's called me again this morning, called me every day, 1-808, the phone number, because he called from Colin Carr. And say, Mary, thank you, Mr. Torres, because in the mission, it wasn't dark night, so one of the soldiers died, two injury. So I know it's a group of like 25 to 30 soldiers, maybe. I wasn't one of the guy injury and die, you know, so I very, very scary. Please do something, please. Just keep your cry again. And now I keep nervous, because look at my son. I remember when I look at my son, he signed it for 4-year contract, but he don't want to go back, so but a military say, if you don't go, you go to the prison. Say, okay, daddy, I go back. 7 years, he go to Afghanistan. I never coming back. And I say, who's control this country? We supposed to control this country. This is the reason I go every day and so mad. When especially last night I go to the meeting for the immigrant meeting. You have the people on the panel. Who is control about the Durbin, about the politic people. So can we get an opportunity if we speak about the war? I say no. So why? Yeah, these people, they control everything. No, because it's only for the immigrant. But, you know, we support the immigrant, you know, because I was immigrant, you know, so many people, American people, they support. About a couple of people, I remember when they arrested the Minutemen rally before, I was there. I was there when this guy had the power. We don't have anything. This guy is coming, you know, up in the church with a rifle. And I see how is they give you permission to take your rifle. This guy is civilian. So I know what really happened in this country, but they look like, I don't know, Second War in Hitler. I don't know. It's a different, but and the last time in Texas, I told the other day, this guy coming, the Bush friend, he go to the same church. What he got? One guy, you know, go close to that, pray everything. And they come over me, see my T-shirt with my son. He said, "Ah, you are Juan Torres." Aha. He told me, "I'm sorry." He told me, "Fuck you, and fuck you, son." I know somebody sent to this guy for say, I don't say anything because sometimes I want it, but I know. He's like, I working for peace, you know. So I want to keep working hard. Also, I remember when one of the time I was in Texas. When the Camp Casey rally in three bus, and my daddy called me from Houston, Texas, from Astrodome, the recruiting guy, they go inside the Astrodome to, visit the 25,000 people that's coming from Katrina. Yeah, this is people that don't take it, they don't care about anything, they don't have, you know, hair. And I say, I'm sorry, but my English is terrible, you know, but I work with my hair. Because I want to do something. I don't want to stay in my house, cry forever, you know? Thank you.
Thank you so much, Juan. We're also very very fortunate to have Anthony Aronoff with us tonight, author of Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal. He was here a few nights ago with Studs Terkel, on the National End the War Tour, which is organized by the New Press, International Socialist Review, Alternate in These Times, IVAW, and Campus Anti-War Network. He's the editor of Iraq Under Siege, co-editor with Howard Zinn of Voices of a People's History of the United States. His writing is pretty prolific, appearing in Financial Times, The Nation, Mother Jones, Monthly Review, and several other publications. We're very happy to have him here with us. And so please, you know, welcome Anthony Aronoff.
Thanks a lot. It's an honor to be here and to speak with Suzanne and to speak with Juan and to be connected with Campus Anti-War Network, which as I go around the country, I've been talking about as an example of the organizing that's happening, and particularly when people ask about what's happening on the campuses, what are students doing, as a model of how students can play an important role in building the anti-war movement. And that movement, if you go back and you look at history, the student anti-war movement during the Vietnam War played a very important role. I think there was a discussion about that earlier I saw on the agenda. And it will play a very important role as this movement develops, and it's already played one. You look at, for example, the figures on recruitment for the military, and it is significant. It is important. 3 years into this war, the U.S. military is having a harder time recruiting people to fight in Iraq, despite the lies, despite the money, despite the increased incentives that they're trying to use to get people into the military. They're having the worst recruitment crisis since right after the Vietnam War. That's because people are looking what's happening in the war, they're seeing through the lies, but it's also because people are going out, they're organizing, are protesting, are kicking recruiters off campus, are confronting them about the lies that they tell to get people into the military, and people are speaking out, and people like Juan are saving lives, and people like Campus Anti-War Network are saving lives by doing that work. There's no question about that. the situation we confront today is a contradictory one. I think, you know, we have to take stock of where we're at if we're going to have a sense of how to move forward. But we're 3 years into this occupation, and I think a couple of things are clear. The first thing that's clear, I think it's important to reiterate, that the anti-war movement was absolutely right about everything we said about this war. You know, if you go back to the beginning, to all the lies that they used to sell the invasion of Iraq, that they used to sell regime change in Iraq, every one of those lies we confronted, we exposed, we challenged as an anti-war movement, whether it was Al-Qaeda being in Iraq or Iraq being connected to 9/11 or Iraq being this imminent threat to the United States, or the idea that the Iraqi people would greet U.S. soldiers with sweets and flowers. It would be a quick occupation. It would be a cheap occupation. U.S. soldiers would be coming home just in a matter of a couple of months. The occupation would be paid for by Iraqi oil, and then there's going to be a sweeping a process of democratization throughout the Middle East, backed by the benevolence of U.S. power in Iraq. And all of those things we as an anti-war movement challenged, and each one of them has been exposed, although the media hasn't changed its behavior as a result of that. It's not as if the media is now coming to the to Juan, as if the media is coming to the anti-war movement for analysis or perspective or to understand how did we get it so wrong and how did you get it right. No, they're going back to the same pundits. They're going back to the same politicians who lied to them before, but now they're giving them a whole new set of lies, which they're putting on the front page of the paper just like they put the old lies on the front page of the paper. The United States is bringing democracy to Iraq. That's the new lie, the new big lie. The United States is stopping civil war in Iraq. That's the other big lie. And that the United States is stopping proliferations of weapons of mass destruction, setting up a kind of a firewall in the Middle East against terrorism and the threat of terrorism. All of those things are lies, and they're new lies that are being used to sell the occupation of Iraq and the possibility of regime change in other countries to a skeptical public. And when I say it's a mixed picture, it's important to stress that the public opinion on this war, which was against it before it happened, but then was swung into support for it through those lies, that idea of Iraq is a threat, Iraq has biological weapons, Iraq has chemical weapons, it has these mobile weapons labs, the ironclad case that supposedly Colin Powell laid out in his case to the United Nations. As all of those things have been exposed, and as they've come up with new lies, we, as an anti-war movement, have to confront them, but also public opinion has shifted drastically, so that now a majority of people in this country oppose the war. A majority of people think the invasion should have never taken place. It was a mistake. And a majority of people want the troops to come home. The other significant thing is the recent poll that came out of public opinion among soldiers in Iraq. I mean, keep in mind, soldiers are disciplined, punished for thinking independently. They're told only to follow orders. They're told that they're never allowed to have a political opinion or have a criticism when they're in the military. They just are to do whatever their commanders say. The soldiers in Iraq, seeing the contradiction between what they were told they would be doing, liberating people, helping people, building schools, and then the reality of what they're doing, killing people, in some cases torturing people, being sent out in patrols into neighborhoods where they're harassing and haranguing people who are resisting them, who oppose them, who resent their presence, who are greeting them not as liberators but as occupiers. Those soldiers now, 72% of them say they want to come home within a year, and 23% say immediately, which is significant. I think those numbers are actually underestimate the degree of sentiment for getting out of Iraq. Given the kind of pressures that are on soldiers to conform, not to speak out, not to think independently. And it's very clear also what the Iraqi people think. It's clear in the demonstrations. It's clear in the daily forms that resistance takes in Iraq. And it's also clear in the opinion polls that have been done. And that's where the whole idea of the United States bringing democracy to Iraq really is so immediately a contradiction. If you are going to bring democracy to the Iraqi people, then let's let the Iraqi people answer a couple of basic questions. Do you want to be under occupation? Yes or no? Let's let the Iraqi people answer that question. It's very clear what they think about that. The U.S. troops would be gone if it were up to the Iraqi people. What about the oil resources of Iraq? What do the Iraqi people want the oil resources? What do they want done with the oil resources? Well, again, that's also very clear. They want the oil resources put to national development, to local needs, not to benefit Western oil companies, not to benefit the United States. There was an opinion poll that was done right after the invasion of Iraq, asking Iraqis, why do you think the United States intervened? 1% said to liberate the Iraqi people. 1%. That's like the 2% of African Americans who said they approve of Bush. It's a statistical anomaly. It's like, it means zero with the margin of error factored in. And, you know, it's like, you know, they got, well, okay. But so they got 1% who believe it was to liberate the people of Iraq. What did they think the reason was for the invasion was? To take control of the resources of Iraq, the energy resources of Iraq, and to reorder the Middle East in a way that would be beneficial to the United States and beneficial to its main ally in the region, Israel. And that's absolutely the real reason for this occupation. Nothing about democracy, nothing about human rights, nothing about terrorism. As Suzanne pointed out very accurately, a whole series of things that were in place in the Clinton administration under the Democrats with regard to Iraq, with regard to the Middle East, with regard to a whole series of foreign policy and domestic policy objectives. When 9/11 happened, it was a green light to advance an agenda that had nothing to do with fighting terrorism or bringing democracy to the Middle East, but had to do with expanding American dominance and control of that region, and through control of that region, extending geopolitical control globally. Because the Middle East, it's not just about whether or not the United States imports oil from Iraq and brings it to the SUVs of people in the suburbs of Chicago. That's not what it's about. It's about the power that comes from controlling Iraqi oil. It's about the fact that when the United States looks down into the future and they see the potential rivals to its status as a sole superpower, able to intervene militarily, economically, politically, in people's affairs all around the world, in countries in Latin America, in Africa, in Asia, wherever it is that they want to open up markets or control people. They see that China is emerging in the future. They talk very openly about it. We're seeing a lot of it right now with the president of China visiting. They see India emerging. They see countries in Europe, and particularly with the European Union, emerging as potential rivals. And they notice something, which is that those countries import far more of their energy resources from the Middle East than does the United States. And they understand that an immense amount of power comes over those other countries if the United States controls the oil of Iraq. If the United States then can use Iraq as a staging ground for military intervention, projection of power in the region, which has 2/3 of world oil reserves, and which also has very important natural gas reserves. And you look right next door to Iraq, Iran. It right now is the second largest exporter of oil in the world, Iran, and is one of the leading countries that has natural gas reserves. And even as short-sighted and oil-addicted as the people who run the United States are, they understand that oil supplies are dwindling and that they're going to have to develop natural gas as a potential supplement to or alternative to oil. And so they're looking down the line to controlling natural gas, not just to controlling oil. So the situation in Iraq is blowing up in their face. Public opinion is against the war. Bush's popularity rating is the worst of any president since Nixon. During the Watergate crisis, not at any just random time in his administration, the public criticism that's now emerging within the ranks of the military, certain generals voicing criticism, you know, over tactical differences, we have to be clear, limited criticisms, but tactical differences that open up cracks among elite opinion about the war. And in that context, all of the things that the administration said would happen in Iraq, not happening, the thing blowing up in their face, but it's not in that situation, it's not as if the Bush administration, as if the Democrats and Republicans are going to be rational people, and they're going to look at the situation, and they're going to conclude that they've done something horrible in Iraq, and that they're just going to fold up shop and come home. Because a lot is at stake for them. Not only all of the power calculations that led them to go into Iraq in the first place, but now the fact that the legitimacy of U.S. empire would be called into question if they were defeated in Iraq. Their ability to intervene in other countries would be hampered, and they see that, and they know what happened after the Vietnam War, when the Vietnam War syndrome limited their ability to intervene in other countries' affairs, made the American public very skeptical about the projection of military power for a number of years. They wanted to get rid of that by going into Iraq, and it would blow up even more. It would be even more significant than the Vietnam syndrome if they were defeated in Iraq. And so when the Bush administration starts talking about Iran the way they are talking about Iran right now, I think we have to take it deadly seriously. If you go back to the Vietnam War, by 1967, when Howard Zinn wrote Vietnam, The Logic of Withdrawal, which is the book that was the inspiration for Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal, the book I just wrote. By 1967, Howard laid out an ironclad case for immediate withdrawal, that the war was the United States had lost the war in Vietnam. He was opposed to it from the beginning. But, you know, from the standpoint of the objectives of military power of the United States, that it could not win in Vietnam. And in 1968, you have the Tet Offensive, a decisive military defeat for the United States. But did they retreat? No, they actually escalated the war and expanded the war into Laos, into Cambodia. Millions of people died before the U.S. was finally compelled to leave Vietnam. And for us, I think we have to take that same challenge very seriously. The United States might expand this war. There's more at stake for them in Iraq than was at stake in 1967 in Vietnam, if you look at how Vietnam fit into the world as an economic and political force. It compares, it doesn't even begin to compare with the importance of Iraq in terms of its geography, its resources, what it symbolizes for the objectives of U.S. imperialism. So it's not only that they might expand the war, but they are talking about intensifying the war. People may have heard of the El Salvador option. This is happening. This is not just abstract ideas. They've armed death squads in Iraq. They're distributing large supplies of weapons. They are encouraging civil war. Far from being the case that U.S. presence in Iraq is preventing civil war from breaking out, it is encouraging and fueling sectarian divisions and conflict. Thomas Friedman, the New York Times columnist, openly advocated this. He said we should arm the Shia, arm the Kurds, and let the Sunni reap the wind, advocating civil war in the pages of the New York Times. That is he's the liberal columnist, by the way. This is not, this is not Rush Limbaugh. This is the liberal opinion, the respectable opinion of the New York Times. Then the Wall Street Journal, a week ago, people may have seen, there was a column in which a strategy that's being discussed now among some of the military people who are critical of the strategy in Iraq was being floated. This sometimes happens where the military has an idea and it gets expressed through someone like the American Enterprise Institute or the Heritage Foundation on the pages of the Wall Street Journal or other magazines and newspapers, and they are now talking about intensifying counterinsurgency operations in Iraq, specifically in Baghdad, the capital of Iraq. And the article called for pacification of Baghdad, even though it said it would lead to skyrocketing body counts and horrific images that would fuel anger and resentment around the world. But that's what we have to do. We have to intensify. So the possibility of an expansion into Iran, the possibility of intensification of this conflict are very real unless there's an escalation of opposition. And churning the sentiment, like the poster for this conference says, turning anti-war sentiment into organized expression, civil disobedience, protest, the kinds of things that can disrupt business as usual. And if you go back to the Vietnam War, I describe in the book how basically five factors came together to compel the United States to leave Vietnam. The first was the resistance of the Vietnamese people, widespread, massive resistance to the war. The second was the opposition at home. The U.S. lost the war at home. And you go back and you look at the internal discussions and Nixon and Johnson talking very openly about we've lost the war of public opinion. There's civil disobedience in the streets. They were losing control of the system, and they were afraid of the consequences of that. There was a rebellion in the military, which was a decisive element. It's often ignored element. But thankfully, there's now a film out, which I think is a tremendous organizing tool. People should get it. Watch it, use it as an organizing tool called Sir, No Sir. It's just coming out in theaters. It's a fantastic documentary about the GI Rebellion during the Vietnam War, the amazing creative organizing that soldiers and veterans did against the war. And there's a book about this, the same story, Soldiers in Revolt, by David Courtwright from Goshen, Indiana, with a new foreword by Howard Zinn, published by Haymarket Books. That tells the story. It's an amazing story. And Courtwright and Zinn bring it all the way up to today in Iraq. And the beginning of an emergence of soldiers like Camilo Mejia, Pablo Paredes, and others speaking out and the importance of that. The fourth and fifth elements were the fact that the United States grew more isolated politically on the international stage, and the costs of the war grew to the point that it had an impact on elites. It was hurting the U.S. economy. There was these cracks opening up at the top that the anti-war movement could take advantage of. And all of those elements are in place today, but none of them alone is strong enough, to stop this war. We see the cracks emerging. We see the opposition in Iraq. We see the economic consequences of this war increasing. But we have to do what we can, which is to strengthen that military resistance, lend whatever support we can to military families, to veterans, to soldiers who are speaking out against this war. And that's why groups like Iraq Veterans Against the War and Gold Star Families are so important. We have to do everything we can to support their work, but also to build the war at home, so that they lose it, that they lose the battle of public opinion, they lose control of the campuses like they did during the Vietnam War. And that's where a group like Campus Anti-War Network can play a decisive role in galvanizing that sentiment, channeling it into the kind of effective protests that can help end this war. Because it's not that just, so much is at stake, not just in Iraq, but really in the world, to forcing the United States out of Iraq. And I'll just I'll leave it there. Thanks.
Thank you so much. The next stops on the End the War Tour are May 1st in San Francisco and May 8th in Seattle, where Anthony will be speaking with Cindy Sheehan. In June, he'll be in London. And there's a blog that is documenting the tour at endthewartour.org.